I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Forrest Fenn. He is an art collector, longtime art gallery owner here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he's lived for nearly four decades. His new book is called The Thrill of the Chase, a memoir, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
One thing that I find fascinating about art collectors is that many of them have been collecting since they were very small, and you talk about in your book your collection of bottle caps, your collections of string that you had when you were very small. Does that for you, is it the same kind of collecting no matter what the object is?
You know, there are some people that don't collect anything, and I think you have to be born with it. My father was a collector. My grandfather was a collector.
What did they collect?
Arrowheads mostly, and ancient things. You know, we love to walk along the creek bottoms and look for signs of ancient man. My father had a huge arrowhead collection that I inherited from him.
Where did you grow up?
Central Texas, Temple.
And those things were just scattered along the ground?
Well, they weren't just scattered along. You had to look for them. But plowed fields, farmers plowed them up. But, you know, that was... I grew up in Comanche and Kiowa country, and I remember my grandmother when I was a little boy telling me about the Kiowas and the Comanches running through her barnyard trying to catch chickens in Fort Worth. And her father told her, you know, just lock the door and leave the Indians alone. If they can catch the chickens, they can have them. So, you know, that's rich in Indian lore, Central Texas, as is New Mexico, of course.
And so you collected as a child, and then you were in the Air Force for 20 years.
For 20 years.
There's a passage in your, there's a section in your memoir about finding the headstone of a French soldier.
Yes.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well, it's a rather long story. In my book, it's rather lengthy. But I went to this clearing in Vietnam, a friend and I, and we tripped over some headstones that were left over, we think, from the French Indochina War. But I tripped over one that was made of stone. And when I turned it over, it had a very poignant inscription on it. If you should ever think of me when I have passed this veil and wish to please my ghost, forgive a sinner and smile at a homely girl. And we were rushed because we had to get out of there. This was enemy country. But it preyed on my mind for a number of years, and I built a story around that, and it had a lasting effect on me.
It's striking that at least it seems to me reading this memoir, that your sense of mortality and the kind of odd nature of time is present throughout your life. In other words, there's a moment here where you talk about the future, and you say, well, what's the future? Give me a date. That we're always somehow looking forward and looking back in this way that's not really so linear.
In the future, there may not be a past like we've known. And it comes with technology and population explosions. You know, we're moving so fast in this planet, we really can't predict. We got into this recession. All of a sudden, we didn't see it coming. And I think that idiosyncrasy of what we're doing on this planet is indicative of what we have to look forward to in the future.
How did you actually get into the business of collecting art and having an art gallery?
Well, when I was in Vietnam, I had a hard tour in Vietnam. I was shot down twice. I lost 22 pounds and didn't even know it because we didn't have any scales. But when I came back to the States after a year, I was kind of beat up, so to speak, and I wanted to find a place where maybe the world would stop and let me off for a while. And I knew about Santa Fe, and I love Santa Fe, and it's the only place I knew of where maybe I could get a job. I knew I wasn't going to wear a watch or a coat and tie, so Santa Fe looked good to me. And I figured if I had to make a living, so I figured maybe I could make a living in art, and that's what prompted me. It was not the love of art. It was a necessity to make a living.
And so how did you start?
I traded for some property here in town and gave some money and started at the very bottom in the art gallery business. The first two shows I had, I didn't sell a piece of art. I didn't even sell a book. But I had a little bit of money left, and so I said, I'm going to spend this money advertising. And if that doesn't work, I said, I'm just going to slam the door and go do something else. But it started working. Advertising pays.
What kind of art were you selling?
Anything I could scrounge from friends or other art galleries. And I didn't have any money to buy art, but we thought we were hustlers. And, you know, we slept on the floor on a mattress, and we painted the building ourselves, my wife and I. Slowly things started to work. Santa Fe is a wonderful place. One good thing about Santa Fe from a business standpoint is people like it as a destination.
And so basically people will come here, they will discover you even without knowing that you were there.
If you have something that they want and the word gets around, they'll find you.
So what ended up being the specialties or the areas that you worked with at your gallery?
Well, since I didn't know what I was doing to start off with, I figured one thing I learned right away was that some of the art galleries in town that were not doing too well were handling the type of art that they themselves loved. And I thought that was a mistake. And I decided I was going to handle the kind of art that somebody else loves, because I wasn't going to buy it for myself. And I've seen lots of galleries in Santa Fe go out of business because they loved what they were selling, or they were selling art by local people that were unknown. And I know there's a real market for that, and I've got a lot of respect for those people. But I just decided that I wanted to handle more expensive things, and it was hard starting out.
And so what was the kind of art that you identified that other people loved that you could sell?
The old tiles painters. There were about 14 or 15 really good painters in tiles. There was a Tile Society, which was 10, and then there were some painters like Nicolas Fish and Leon Gaspard and some of the others. And we started building those names. They were relatively unknown in 1972. But over a period of a short period, two or three years, while their fame mounted, and today it's a really big time.
What was the kind of art that you loved that you decided not to sell?
That I loved that I decided not to sell?
Yeah, because you say, okay, I'm not going to sell the art that I love. Were the things that you collected just for yourself?
Well, you know, I didn't have any money for a lot of years, and everything I collected I couldn't afford to keep. So I tried to keep some things, but, you know, when it comes to make a payroll, you have to make decisions. But I like Indian things, Plains Indian particularly, but Southwestern. I like pots and baskets, and I like the lore of the West and the fun of reading about the West.
You ended up doing very well at this gallery, and I thought it was interesting because you have, if I understand correctly, it ended up amassing a very large and significant collection yourself. Was there a turning point where you really started to do well both for yourself and in selling the work at your gallery?
Well, one thing that I can say for myself is that I never had to borrow money to make payroll. And that was my way I measured myself. If you have to borrow money to pay your employees, then something's wrong. But, you know, my motivation was to find a great object. Anybody can sell a great painting, but not everybody can find one. And I told my clients, I said, if you're in town at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning and you want to come see me, give me a phone number and I'll open for you.
Did that ever happen?
It happened. Waylon Jennings called me one time about 2 o'clock in the morning. He had some friends in town, and they had been drinking, and he wanted to open the gallery, and I did.
There is the process of selling objects, and then also there's the stories. And I have a close friend who worked in an art gallery for a while, and she said to me, she said, I'm not even selling art. I'm selling stories. I'm telling people stories, and that's what makes them buy.
Very interesting that you suggest. Mention that, because when I was a kid, I started making rules for myself. And one of the rules that I made later on was this. It doesn't matter who you are. It only matters who they think you are. That's how Neiman Marcus got there, and that's how Andy Warhol got there. And it goes right into what your friend was saying. It's the story that sells. Of course, you want to be as honest as you can, but everybody embellishes just a little bit.
Now, I was reading somewhere that you bought some land that had a ruin of an Indian pueblo on it.
Yes, San Lazaro Pueblo.
And you started excavating that yourself?
Yes. Archaeology has been a hobby of mine since I found my first arrowhead when I was 9 years old in Texas with my father. And since my father was a collector and my football coach, we went out together on the weekends, and it's a wonderful thing for parents to take their kids out in the countryside, whether it's collecting arrowheads or fishing or whatever. And I grew up in that kind of an environment, and I loved it.
And so you bought this, essentially, pueblo and began to excavate it. Did you work with archaeologists? Were you pretty much going solo?
Both. I have a good friend in Wyoming by the name of George Siemens, has a master's degree in archaeology. And each summer he brings underprivileged kids from Wyoming. We call them underappraised kids from Wyoming down, and they camp out at the pueblo, and they excavate, each one of them has a tent, and you know they stay a couple of weeks, and it's very rewarding for them and for us. We pay them a salary, or they couldn't afford to come down, and we give each one of them two pairs of hiking shoes, and you know, it's really a good setup.
That's the kind of story that I would imagine that people who are working within the institutions of archaeology, who are writing books about archaeology, would say that this should be done by professionals.
Well, you know, Mary, there's some argument there, but you know, there are things more important than archaeology. If we're going to save this planet today, we're going to do it with our youth. And we need to get them involved in something. We need to get them off the streets. We need to get the graffiti people out doing something that's productive. And I don't think any longer that we can say that these sciences like archaeology, they can't be on an island to themselves. They have to participate, and they have to give something back. And archaeology is something that's easy to love, and I don't think archaeologists do nearly enough to help the situation we find. We're in trouble in this country, particularly with our youth.
Very interesting. So have you seen young people's lives be affected and turned around by this process of excavating?
Sure. Some of these kids that come down in the summertime, we have to have parole officers' permission to get them out of the state. One boy had a $25 car, and it ran for 25 miles, and so we bought him a car. I've got some friends in the car business here, and we bought him a really good used car. And we got a telephone call from his mother and said, don't bring him back. I don't want him back again. And his father was gone, so he didn't have any place to go. We put him in a junior college in Wyoming. And I have a good friend here in town, Jim Taylor, who's chairman of the United World College in Las Vegas. We've gotten some of our kids scholarships over there. And we see these kids grow up, and I get emails from kids that were here 10 years ago, and it's very rewarding to me to see what's happening.
The book is called The Thrill of the Chase. Mm-hmm. Talk more about that title and the things in life that have been thrilling for you that you've chased.
You know, there's a great quote in the new Joe Devine book. It says, they never knew that it was the chase they sought and not the quarry. Isn't that interesting? And like I mentioned a while ago, the great thrill for me in the art business was to find a great painting, the thrill of the chase. It's easy to sell it, but to find it, to walk into somebody's house and see a great painting, it's just like finding a great arrowhead laying on the ground or catching a nice fish. And with women and men too, they go in antique shops and we go into garage sales for the same reason. It's the thrill of the chase. And I think that title fit my book perfectly.
Now, is it true that you found Sitting Bull's pipe?
No, I didn't find it, but I own it.
Yeah. You found it somewhere.
Yeah, it came out of a little museum in Minnesota where a lot of Sitting Bull's relatives retired. And I've had it for a few years. It's a very important piece.
What happens to that piece eventually? Are you going to give it to a museum? Do you know?
Well, I haven't decided. You know, it could go a lot of different places. What I would like to do is sell it to a museum and use the money for some of the things that I think are important, like improving education for our youth. And, you know, I've always thought that our museums are not doing enough to solve the problem either. If I were a museum director, I would take a gang leader to the museum, show him around, try to get him interested in something, and give him some responsibility, some authority, and maybe he can bring his buddies in. And, you know, I think we're desperate to do something. And that's what I would like to do. I'm 80 years old, you know, so I'm starting a little bit late. But when I was a kid in the 1930s and 40s, drugs meant aspirin. And the really, really, really bad kids were smoking cigarettes. You know, so I remember a bunch of kids and myself got in a friend's pickup truck one night about midnight, and we had a garbage can full of garbage. And we drove down Main Street in Temple, Texas, and we threw that garbage can out on the street. And garbage just flew everywhere. Let me tell you, it was headlines in the paper the next day, and the next day, and the next day. Worst thing that had happened in that town in a long time. And that's how I grew up, and I see things happening today, and I just shake my head. You know, I think every generation decides that theirs is going to be the last because we can't survive the way we're going.
Well, I mean, apparently on, you know, in ancient Mesopotamian artifacts and hieroglyphics that survive, somebody somewhere has written, these kids today, how are we going to...
That's true. That's why I'm saving a lot of my arrowheads. I may need them in the next war.
Now, you have done something quite unusual and I think fascinating to many, which is that you buried a treasure chest somewhere in the hills or mountains north of Santa Fe and have left clues in your memoir whereby people can find it.
I've taken this treasure chest to a very secret and very special place and I've hidden it there. And there are 9 clues in my book. You have to read the book. But if you have an imagination and you have a pretty good mind and you have a little bit of resolve, you can find that treasure chest. The first one to it can have it.
You've also made some bronze bells with inscriptions on them.
That's right. And I like that part in my book where I talk about the future. You know, I've buried 8 bells in jars, and all of them have sayings that I elevated around the... I cast them in bronze at a Shidoni foundry in Tosuke. And one of them says, ring the bell loudly, for he who dies with over $50 is a failure. Another one says, if you should ever think of me 1,000 years from now, please ring my bell so I will know. And I'm burying these bells deep, just indiscriminately, out in the desert. And I don't want anybody to find them for 1,000 years or 10,000 years. But when someone does find one accidentally and reads that inscription and sees my name and the date, 2007 or 2008, they're going to say, good Lord, look who this, you know, the man that carved the Rosetta Stone, that thing was hidden for 2,000 years before it was found. And that's the kind of thing that my imagination runs wild when I start talking about these things. And I said in my book, is all of New Mexico going to be covered with houses and asphalt to the point where we can't go outside and look across the desert for the thrill of seeing nothing at all? We don't know where we're going. Things are happening too fast.
Yeah. Forrest Fenn is a longtime art gallery owner, art collector. His new memoir is called The Thrill of the Chase, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. It's really great to meet you and great to have you on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news, and then jazz.